Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is our behavior free will or parasites? New science shows how parasites change behaviors throughout the animal kingdom. Then, for this Valentine's week, we explored the phenomenon of love. They may have been some of the world's greatest or most influential thinkers, but they were also great failures at love. Finally, on the Scholar Circle, what is love? Is it emotional, biological? Can it be summoned by rational decision? And how does it play out in society? For many years, scientists and philosophers have explored how much human behavior is programmed and how much is actually free will. But now, there's another factor. Parasites. Parasites have been found to change animal behaviors, sometimes quite drastically. What does that mean for human behavior? Dixon DePommier is with us. He is a microbiologist, ecologist, and emeritus professor at Columbia University. His books include The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, and People, Parasites, and Plowshares, Learning from Our Body's Most Terrifying Invaders. Patrick House also joins us. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of a key paper about how one parasite makes rodents lose their fear of cats. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Dr. DePommier, I would like to start with kind of the basics on the relationship of parasites to animal behavior. I understand parasites feed on their hosts, but sometimes they drive the behaviors of their hosts. What are some examples of this?
Absolutely. There are lots of them. In fact, there are many more to be discovered since we have only recently, I think, come to realize that nature has a series of interlocking behaviors associated with systems that tend to reinforce each other. So parasitism is a system. I don't mean to sound highfalutin on this, but everybody has a basic concept of what an ecosystem is. And if you can imagine all the plants and animals that live within a given region that could be defined as an ecosystem, virtually all those animals and plants that you can see turn out to be what we would call free-living animals or plants. If you look inside them, however, you will find that they have a collection of other organisms. Some of them are good, like the organisms that live inside our intestinal tract, for instance, the bacteria, and some of the viruses as well. But there are other organisms called parasites, which are there to take advantage of these, what we would call successful systems. So in order to do that, of course, these parasites have to be able to get from one host to another. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them alter the behavior of their hosts in order to ensure the fact that they'll be transmitted from one animal or one plant to another. And you asked me for examples. I'll just give you the one that I find the most fascinating, but I'm sure there are tons of them out there. It involves a parasite called Spirometramansinoides. It's a tapeworm. And this tapeworm lives inside the small intestinal tract of cats and other felines like bobcats and panthers and tigers and things of this sort. In order to catch this tapeworm, the cat or feline has to catch another animal and eat it because the parasite has a stage that lives inside the other animal. Well, it turns out that most of these other animals that cats have to catch in order to eat turn out to be either snakes or fish or amphibians. And they're usually pretty fast, especially the amphibians. They tend to jump and hide. You know, they crawl up trees and they escape from their predators, which is the cat. But this particular parasite secretes something, we think we know what it is now, something into its what we would call the host that will give the cat the parasite, in this case a frog, that makes the frog grow uncontrollably so that the frog actually gets bigger and slower and more sluggish, just like we would get if we were to eat too much and become obese. These obese frogs, containing the stage that the cat needs to catch in order to get the tapeworm, become very easy for the cats to catch. And so as a result, the parasite has modified the behavior of the stage of the infection that the cat needs to come in contact with in order to complete the life cycle. Now, that's pretty sophisticated biology, but I mean, it gives you an example of how complicated and how complex life has become through, I would say, billions of years of evolution. There are plenty of other examples like this.
I read about one parasite that actually rewires an ant's brain, its neurons, and then kind of hijacks its body.
That's correct. So that the ant becomes eaten by something else, and then that gives that something else the stage of the parasite that it needs to go on with its life. That's true for a lot of associations that you can find in nature. The more you look for them, the more you find them.
How often do you see this kind of behavior alterations in higher level animals? What about human beings?
I'm not a psychiatrist, nor am I a psychologist. I'm a parasitologist, although in some cases people have mistaken that name and asked me if I was a parapsychologist. So the answer is I'm a parasitologist. And the examples that I could give you from nature's enormous volumes of stories along these lines is the one that I think maybe Patrick House could be better to explain with regards to, I believe you're referring to Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite. And in fact, it's probably the most widely distributed infectious agent on the planet. Not only does it infect all mammals, but it infects most of the cells inside of most mammals. So it's almost a universal parasite. John Boothroyd, who also works at Stanford, he almost is convinced that this, in many cases, is not a parasite, but rather is a symbiont.
And it's rather a what? That, I'm sorry, say that again?
A symbiont.
A symbiont.
That actually helps in some ways to stimulate the immune system and to keep the organisms alive long enough to allow these parasites to be transmitted to other animals over long distances. That becomes a strategy. I mean, a parasite might want to keep its host alive for a long time in order to move away from the source of infection so that other animals can also become infected. So we have these strategies that parasites have evolved as well.
Patrick House, let's bring you in. You have been studying this particular parasite, and one of your findings pertains to how it changes the behavior of rats and makes them more vulnerable to their predators, cats. What happens?
One of the interesting things is that if you actually look at this broad range of parasites that manipulate their host behavior, you actually find most of them in insects. So it'll change the behavior of maybe an ant or maybe a cricket. There are examples of these particular ones. Also, I believe a cockroach. There's one wasp that will actually inject something into a cockroach. But if you think about it, on the level of complexity, these are actually rather simple organisms, insects. I mean, they don't have brains per se as we define them. And what I think makes this particular Toxoplasma parasite interesting is that actually it's one of very few things, if not the only thing that we know of, that actually gets into mammalian brains, sits there, and doesn't actually end up killing the host. This idea that the parasite may actually be sitting in the brain for years, months, kind of across the vast majority of the host's life is interesting, because then you can ask, well, what, if any, possible changes in behavior are there? Because, you know, the brain is the seat of a lot of these, of what we consider to be will. So this particular parasite has to get and can only sexually reproduce. And by sexually, I mean it can only combine its genes around inside the cat. So again, we have cat as an origin for one of the most interesting things in kind of this manipulation hypothesis for parasites. So the parasite is actually stuck in a cat. It has to get from one cat to another cat. How does it do that? It doesn't have legs of its own. And it uses rats and mice and other intermediate hosts to actually ferry itself, to kind of taxi from one cat to the other cat. And what we think is happening is that it's getting into the brain of these rats and somehow making it such that that individual rat is more likely to then get eaten by the cat, which passes on the parasite. And my work has shown, when I looked in the brains of the rats that had this parasite and exposed them to a cat, it actually looked similar to when we took an uninfected animal, uninfected male rat, and exposed it to a female rat. Well, one possibility is that you're making them less afraid of the cat. And another possibility is that you're actually making them attracted to the cat. So what I showed is that maybe there's some hint that what's actually happening is this parasite is making these rats actually attracted to the smell of cats.
Which then makes them prey.
Which then makes them spend more time where cats are, which then makes them more likely to get eaten. I mean, there's a very good reason that rats are, rats and mice alike, anything that a cat, you know, predates, is quite afraid of the smell of a cat because it means imminent doom.
This really does raise the question whether or not we have free will. There's certainly the evolutionary aspect anyway, certain programming, but now we're talking about microorganisms having effect over animal behavior. This particular parasite, Patrick House, that you've been studying is also present in people. What's the scope of the presence and how does it affect people that we know of?
Estimates are maybe a fifth to a third of the world, entire world, all 6, 7, I don't know how many there are anymore, 6 or 7 billion people. So it is one of definitely the most common parasites in the world. And you might then ask, if you're getting into numbers that large, at what point we can even really figure out what, if anything, this parasite's doing. So people mostly get it, we believe, through eating raw meat. The parasite ends up in a lot of different animals, a lot of different mammals, including cows, sheep, pigs, goats, everything that we eat. And in countries that seem to eat more raw meat, you tend to get higher infection rates. So France and Brazil, steak tartare, Brazilian barbecues, things like that, you actually have some of the highest rates in the world in these two countries. Another possible route is through cat ownership. So the parasite is actually transmitted through the cat poop. And if you don't clean your litter, or rather, if you clean your litter box well and don't clean your hands well afterwards, people can often ingest it that way. So people do have it. We definitely know that people have it in their brains. And the question is, what, if anything, is it doing? So even if we know that it's changing rat behavior, that gives us no certain indicator that it's changing human behavior, because our brains are, you know, they're similar in some respects, but they're very, very different in many. And one of the interesting things is, well, you have the parasite sitting in a rat brain for maybe a few months, maybe a few years. They don't live very long. But when you have it in a human, and you have it in a human for decades, is it possible that something is coming out, some perturbation is happening that is just very difficult to recognize? So we really don't know. I mean, if you go into a doctor's office and you have toxoplasma, just the parasite, you just test for the parasite and you do have it, you can do a blood test and they'll tell you. That doctor will do nothing special for you. You are not considered sick. That's not a disease in and of itself. So right now, clinically, there's no consequence to having the parasite.
One of the illnesses that I saw had a correlation with this particular toxoplasma was schizophrenia.
Yes.
Do we know if the correlation means anything yet?
I want to make two caveats to what I just said, which is that it is very dangerous in two cases. One being if you're immunocompromised. So in HIV patients, for example, which is one way that a human can become immunocompromised, toxoplasmosis, which is the actual clinical version, can be fatal. In addition, it can be very, very bad for fetuses. If a pregnant woman picks up the parasite for the first time, the same way that the parasite gets into our brain, it can actually get into the baby's brain. So there are circumstances. I didn't mean to say that it was just a harmless parasite. As to the kind of correlations with mental illness, so this is one of the most, I think, one of the most interesting things about this, and really the reason I'm studying it. And what I would say is that we know, for instance, for just with schizophrenia, that there are people with schizophrenia that do not have this parasite, and there are people with this parasite that do not have schizophrenia. So it's not a one-to-one link. By no means will it turn out. I mean, many, many more people have the parasite in the world, like I said, maybe up to a third, than do schizophrenia. But it's one of these really tricky things where we don't really know what causes schizophrenia to begin with, and we don't really know what this parasite does. So when you're asking about the correlation between the two, you're really asking to kind of make a link between two things we don't know much about. And it's the kind of strongest link that we have out there is maybe around 50, between 50 and 60 studies now have shown that if you have schizophrenia, you're more likely to have this parasite. That's certainly interesting. Like, that's the first nugget of, you know, how scientific hypotheses develop. And now we have to investigate that further. But it's quite likely that actually what could happen, maybe, just as an example, people with schizophrenia tend to have poor hygiene, tend to take less good care of themselves. And that could actually lend to maybe undercooking your meat or not washing your hands, or, you know, schizophrenia can make you more likely to pick up the parasite.
Let me thank you, Patrick House, and let me also thank Dixon DePommier.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest says that while many of us have some failures in love, few have failed as badly as our great thinkers and writers. Andrew Schaffer joins us. His books are called Great Philosophers Who Failed at Love and Literary Rogues, A Scandalous History of Wayward Authors. Welcome, Andrew Schaffer.
Thank you for having me.
These great philosophers were not so great at love, it seems. You suggest that they were largely unsuitable for marriage. Many died miserable, bitter, and alone. Were there any that you looked at that really had model love lives?
The funny thing is, I had actually planned to do a second book, which was going to be like Great Philosophers Who Succeeded at Love. But the problem was, like, I really couldn't find enough examples of that. I think if you look at anybody's love life in enough detail, you sort of see the cracks. And really, that's just sort of the nature of, you know, being human. We make mistakes. So on a long enough timeline, I was always able to really find fault with people's love lives.
Some of them were, compared to what we have in our own lives, perhaps really dramatic. Why do you think that so many were unsuitable for marriage and healthy love lives?
I mean, it was something that I had thought about for a long time. I mean, being a writer myself, you just sort of see people that spend a lot of time in their own heads writing and being a philosopher, which kind of go hand in hand, but it's something that you don't really turn off. The philosophers, they didn't just do 9-to-5 day job of philosophy and then go home and turn it off and be a model husband or wife or parent. And that's the same thing that sort of goes with writers and a lot of creative people, is you're locked into that mindset for 24 hours a day. So it's kind of hard to get away from your work. I looked at over and over with philosophers, their love lives and, you know, really the rest of their social lives, they weren't able to live up to some of the same ideals that they had as far as what they thought a model life should be. So it really was something that I think that was specific. But again, if you look at really anybody's life in enough detail, you can sort of find fault with it.
When we look at the philosophers, some had some level of success in their love life, a couple like Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir.
From, you know, one sort of perspective, they had a very successful open relationship, and it would be very difficult to find fault with the love that they had together, except Simone wanted a little bit more from it, it seemed, than Jean-Paul wanted from the relationship. Although she went along with it, it was clear that at some point she would have been open to marriage, and that was just a line that he did not want to cross. And so he had many different girlfriends over the years, and she also had another boyfriend, Nelson Algren, at one point another writer from Chicago. And the problem was that they never really told the people that they were dating that they were still involved or that they were in multiple relationships at the same time. So while I don't think there's anything wrong with those open relationships, there were certainly some people that their feelings got hurt, or they were sort of seeing people behind each other's backs that they didn't really know about.
And sometimes they pursued the same person.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they would try to seduce the same woman without letting that woman know what was going on. So clearly, that was something that was a cruel game that they played together.
The other thing about Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir was both of them adopting as their children one of their lovers.
Basically, they both wanted someone to carry on their legacy. And seeing as how they had not married each other and had not had any children, the one way to get around that was to adopt their lovers. And especially in Simone's case, I think she adopted her girlfriends because they couldn't get married at the time, obviously. It probably sounds worse than it actually was.
Several of the great thinkers were consummate bachelors. You had Nietzsche, of course. It sounded like Locke was a consummate bachelor. How many bachelors did you have that never married, never had a permanent relationship?
There were quite a few. Some of them fell into the category where it was a religious reason that they were bachelors and that they didn't feel right pursuing women. Kant was one of those. He believed that any premarital sex was immortal, and he just had really a problem with sexual desire. He would get married at one point, but it just never happened for him. because he really didn't have the money. So that was another aspect. A lot of these guys didn't feel they had the money to really support a wife, since most of these were men, were bachelors. There were others, like Nietzsche, who was just so incredibly down on love and romance. And he said stuff like, ah, women, they make the highs higher and the lows more frequent. Which is, it's kind of funny, but it's kind of sad that this wasn't just some kind of humorous aphorism that he was saying. This was something that he truly believed. And from his only experience with women, he actually picked up syphilis, and that affected him and his career very negatively, obviously, and eventually he ended up in an insane asylum from that.
Who finally ended up in a relationship that worked? Bertrand Russell.
He was married many times, but towards the end of his life, with his fourth wife, who is 30 years younger than he was, he got involved with a woman who was 50. And they lived another 18 years together until he died at the age of 98. And that was his fourth wife. And I don't think that he ever thought really that any of his relationships were wasted. He had three marriages before that that didn't work out. But I think he was very practical. When you live to be 98, to find just one person over that great length of time, it sounds like a very difficult thing and is not very practical from a long view.
And then there was Martin Heidegger, who discovered that his son was actually not his own, but at the same time, he was having an affair with his students.
He's come under a lot of fire for being a Nazi sympathizer, but his girlfriend, who was actually his student, was Jewish, and he was a Nazi sympathizer, and he actually helped her to get out of Germany in 1933, I think it was. Then he actually joined the Nazi party. But she was very interested. She forgave him for being a Nazi, whereas I think a lot of the world after that did not forgive him.
Are you speaking specifically about Hannah Arendt or one of his other girlfriends?
Oh, yeah, Hannah.
His wife, of course, was having affairs and gave birth to a son, and he discovered that it wasn't his own.
He and his wife were together for 60 years, while he pretty much carried on this other relationship with Hannah. And they never really separated. They didn't divorce. But he did have relationships with multiple students. You look at it and say, well, she didn't leave him for 60 years or something. And his affairs were sort of public knowledge. Her biographer didn't find out about this until 2005, when some letters were published between Heidegger and his wife.
Lord Byron was perhaps the most dysfunctional of all your literary rogues in terms of love.
Oh, my goodness. You know, where do you begin with Lord Byron? He was just a very unusual guy. He was very charismatic, very, very eccentric, and very, very sexual. He seems a little bit like Russell Brand or something, in that he was very charming, but at the same time, of a rogue. He did very strange things. He drank wine out of a human skull from one of his ancestors. He had a pet bear. He fired off guns indoors when he was bored. And he also slept with hundreds of women and men over the course of his lifetime. He never really wanted to settle down, but he eventually had to because he was sort of running low on money. He was always in debt. He had to get married to sort of shore up his finances. But at the same time that he got married, he was having an affair with his half-sister. He even invited his half-sister along on his honeymoon, which did not sit well with his wife. So right from the beginning, marriage was not something that was going to work out for him. You know, this guy who had slept with hundreds of women and men.
While he was married to her, didn't he also impregnate his half-sister?
So during the first year of his marriage, he impregnated his wife. But then he also impregnated his half-sister, which was not so good. It was so scandalous. This wasn't something that was acceptable at the time, to impregnate your half-sister. This was not, oh, it was okay. It wasn't, you know, they were kind of backwards in the past. No, this was something that was quite scandalous. And when the details of this started to leak out, he actually had to leave England. And so he fled, and then he was sort of on the run from England for the rest of his life.
And finally, Edgar Allan Poe. He married his cousin, who was only 13 years old. What was his love life like?
Edgar Allan Poe, he was very interesting because he was very poor. He tried to make a living on his short stories and magazine editing, but because he was severely alcoholic and it made it hard for him to hold a job. And he had a couple of close calls with women where he thought he was going to get married, where he proposed to them, and it sort of fell through. One theory was because they didn't approve of his drinking. And so he was really a wreck pretty much for his whole life. And at one point, he was trying to support his aunt and his cousin, who also didn't have a lot of money. And he ended up proposing to his cousin and marrying her. Again, that wasn't something that was sort of acceptable in his day, because if you were under 18, you had to get your parents' permission to get married in the state of Virginia. So this was very unusual, you know, that he would marry her. So it wasn't for money or anything, and it was because he said he loved her. And unfortunately, that did not last for a long time, because she got very sick and died. So it ended up being a very tragic story, and then that sort of then haunted him for the rest of his days.
Well, Andrew Schaefer, thank you so much for being with us. Andrew Schaefer is the author of Great Philosophers Who Failed at Love and Literary Rogues, A Scandalous History of Wayward Authors. You're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and here is This Week in History with Spencer Downing.
This is Spencer Downing. Few of us will escape this week without some thought turning to Valentine's Day. As you agonize over how best to prove your love, or best to revel in your singleness, take a moment to appreciate Valentine's unsung heroes. The sex radicals, the free lovers, the anarchists, and the feminists. In short, those anti-establishment types who put forward the crazy proposition that love between people should be a personal choice deserving of public respect. A quick glance at any wiki-type encyclopedia will remind us that Valentine's Day traditions harken back to the ideals of medieval courtly love. The poetry of courtly love imagined great passion, often unrequited, between a high-ranking woman and her suitor who performed great deeds to win her attention and affection. Presumably, the two were not married to each other. Their love could never become public, and the pain associated with the impossible situation was part of the pleasure of the relationship. In a world where marriages were usually founded on property relationships, the idea of love that's based on ardor and desire could seem very romantic. Long after the feudal system that supported courtly love had disappeared, sentimentalists attempted to couch those romantic elements within marriage. At the same time, feminists, anarchists, and other radicals began arguing that the very institution of marriage itself ought to be reconsidered, if not trashed completely. In 1792, as the United States was still struggling to find itself, the English writer Mary Wollstonecraft published A Vindication of the Rights of Women. Scholars still dispute how much of a feminist she was, but in refusing to marry her partners, she emphasized the importance of personal choice over social convention. The United States had its own share of free love advocates. Many protested unjust marriage laws that gave all power to men, and for others, it was the very notion that anyone could dictate who a person loved. In 1871, Victoria Woodhull declared, "Yes, I'm a free lover. I have an inalienable, constitutional, and natural right to love whom I may, and with that right, neither you nor any law you can frame have any right to interfere." Our understandings have changed a lot since then. Thanks to feminists, civil rights activists, LGBTQ advocates, and other justice-minded people, we've reconsidered and restructured the legal frameworks of our relationships, including marriage. Just as important, most of us take for granted that those relationships are based on individual choice. I'm Spencer Downing with The Week in History.
When we come back, what exactly is love? How does it develop? And how has it changed over time? Stay tuned.
What's love? Got to do it. What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? What's love got to do with it? What's love but a sweet old-fashioned notion? What's love got to do with it?
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this Valentine's week, we're exploring the big questions of love. What is love exactly? How have notions of love changed over time? Can love be consciously developed? And how does love for partner, friends, children, and country differ? With us are three scholars. Simon May is with us. He is visiting professor of philosophy at King's College in London and author of numerous books, including Love, A History, and Nietzsche's Ethics and His War on Morality. Bennett Helm also joins us. He is professor of philosophy at Franklin and Marshall College. His books include Love, Friendship, and the Self, and Emotional Reason, Deliberation, Motivation, and the Nature of Value. Robert Epstein also joins us. He is senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. He's currently working on a book called Making Love, How People Learn to Love and How You Can Too. He's also the author of Cognition, Creativity, and Behavior, Selected Essays. Thank you so much for being with us. Simon May, I want to start with you. You've said that over time, love has become like a religion, and as a result, perhaps it's ossified. Free love hasn't freed love, maybe caged it instead. How is love like a religion, and what happened to get us here?
I think love is like a religion because it's come to take on many of the attributes that were previously or currently attributed by religious people to God. In other words, we claim that we love, for example, unconditionally, that we love selflessly, and that our love, or at least our genuine love, is enduring, or in some sense even eternal. And those are qualities, to be unconditional, to be selfless, and to be eternal. Those are really divine qualities that don't apply to anything, in my view, that human beings do, which is always conditional and is always time-limited. And is in one way or another always self-interested. I think even altruism can be self-interested.
So you're saying, in essence, these ideals that we hold about love are unrealistic. How did we then come to embrace them?
Well, I have a particular story about that, which is that essentially the view gained ground. So it's relatively recent, if you look at the whole history of Western thought, in the Protestant Reformation, that human beings were deemed unable to love at all without divine grace. So the odd result was that human beings got, if you like, deified by that. In fact, Luther, the founder of the Reformation, even said that human beings could become gods through love. Because we were so incapable of loving ourselves, we could only love if God, so to speak, inspired us to love through his own love. Now, of course, his own love, by definition, is unconditional because God isn't conditioned by anything beyond him. So this is how the thought came into being, that human love could be unconditional. But religion always had a countervailing doctrine of modesty. It always said that if we could love unconditionally, it was only because God was infusing it into us. And I think that when we came to the 18th century, to the Enlightenment, and to the beginning of the decline of belief in religion, even by religious people, I can explain what I mean by that later if you wish, we were left with the conceit that we could love unconditionally, but we dropped the doctrine of modesty that we needed God's grace to do so. And I think that that is basically where we are today.
Well, you said that as a result of this, love has become ossified. What did you mean by that?
What I mean by that, human beings have a fundamental religious need. In other words, we need to have some value that we hold as absolutely supreme and in a sense as redeeming the horrors and the losses and the sufferings of life. And a lot of things have been tried since faith in God started getting wobbly. Science, technology, capitalism, communism, and a bevy of other isms have been tried, and one by one they've been found wanting. But only love has somehow kept its hold over the... And I'm talking about largely now about the Western imagination. I don't want to speak for cultures beyond the West. I think that because love has exerted this unique hold, we've been terrified to allow it to evolve. So I point out, for example, in the book to which you referred, that while we've had a tremendous revolution in, say, freeing sexuality, we have not at the same time freed love. So the pill, the admission of gay love, and obviously, you know, much freer sex heterosexually has all happened during the 20th century and into the 21st. But the concepts, but the way in which we think of love itself has remained remarkably fixed or even ossified.
Bennett Helm, would you agree?
There are a number of things that I would tend to disagree with in what Simon has just said.
It's not clear to me that we need a value that we hold absolutely supreme. I think it's important to see that part of what's distinctive of human life is that we do have things that we find to be valuable. And in part, we define our identities as persons through the various things that we find to be valuable. And in this, I think love plays a central and important role. Part of what I think happens in love is that you find the other person to be valuable, and you come to value the things that the other person values for that person's sake. That's a kind of intimate identification that I think is really at the root of love. I would want to pass on some of the historical considerations that Simon has just alluded to. I'm not a historian, not even a historian of philosophy. But to a certain extent, I would agree with Simon that it is unrealistic to say that we love unconditionally, that we love selflessly and eternally. But the difficult task in trying to understand the nature of love is really to understand how it is that love can be conditioned on who the beloved is, what kind of role that yourself has to play in the loving of someone else, and the ways in which we can be justified in coming to love someone, the way in which we can be justified in ceasing to love someone or continuing to love someone. So those are all important questions, philosophical questions, that any account of love needs to sort of take on and try to give an answer to.
You were alluding to one of your concepts, which is this evaluative aspect of love. And I just briefly wanted to understand what you meant by that.
Love is partly an emotional response. I don't think of love itself as an emotion. I think love is a mode of concern that we have that is constituted by a variety of emotions. And when you start looking at the emotions, particular emotions are going to evaluate their objects in various kinds of ways. So in the simplest case, you know, think of a relatively simple emotion like fear. You're evaluating the object as dangerous, as threatening something that you care about, something that's important to you. So there's an evaluative aspect to emotions quite generally. The emotions that I think are most relevant to thinking about love are what I call person-focused emotions. These are emotions like pride and shame that essentially take persons as their objects, and they involve evaluations of those persons as ennobled, for example. Well, depending on the circumstances, you're evaluating the person in terms of the quality of that person's life in having these various sorts of emotions. And I think that's an important way in which we come to identify with someone in this distinctively intimate sort of way that love is.
Robert Epstein, you have looked at this from a different perspective in terms of love, mostly romantic love, and you've done a bit of historic evaluation on this as well. Let's start there and then go into the actual concept of developing love.
You know, I've looked at love in different cultures. I've looked at love historically. As a research psychologist, I tend to collect data and kind of draw conclusions from data. And I have to agree with some of the things actually that Simon May said, because love was actually not very important, certainly in marriages for a long, long time. Still not very important in many cultures, believe it or not. But it has become, over time, in Western cultures, especially in Europe and the U.S., it has become more important over time. So if you go back 100 years, the vast majority of people who married in the U.S. and Europe would say that they would marry without love. It wasn't necessary. It wasn't a requirement. But at this point, certainly in the U.S., 90 to 95% of people who marry say that they would not marry unless there was love. So there have been changing attitudes, and we have locked in on certain ideas about love. They're really myths. It's exactly what Simon was talking about. I talk about them in the context of mythology, but there are a lot of myths that surround the modern concept of love. And from my perspective, these are myths that actually harm people, and myths that harm relationships, because they set up expectations that real relationships just cannot fulfill. And as a result, relationships fail. People end up in therapy or divorce court. So indeed, we are locked into certain ideas about love which are false.
You know, both you and I believe Simon May have written about this aspect. Simon May, you called it consumerism and how it has changed our concept of love. And I don't think that's what you called it, Robert Epstein, but
I think it was a related concept.
Actually, if I can just butt in here.
Yes,
no, I didn't say that consumerism has changed our concept. On the contrary, what I said was that the, so to speak, consumerist attitude to love, in other words, because of the acceptability of divorce and the social acceptability of breakup of relationships and the availability of contraception and the like, we are more able, in fact, to pursue the traditional ideal than ever before because, to use the current jargon, we can move on from one relationship to the other or from one marriage to the other. And so what I'm saying, and this is part of my point about ossification, is that the, in a sense, the ideal of love, the concept of what we're looking for, has more or less stayed the same. But the consumerism of love, in other words, being able to look for it, as it were, change one model for another and so on, has enabled us to pursue the ideal in an ever more aggressive way. I mean, sometimes literally aggressive way. So, though people very often say it's either consumerism or it's idealism, I see the consumerism as reinforcing the idealism.
Robert Epstein, I heard you coming in.
Well, yes, I would agree there. And again, we're moving in a direction which is probably going to do more harm when it comes to love, because the internet has made it easier than ever just to keep moving on. I call it the click problem when it comes to love, because we have an ideal that is virtually impossible to match, certainly for any length of time in any real relationship. And so we just click. And we move on to someone else and someone else and someone else. It's as if we're standing at a bar that's 1,000 miles long. There's an endless supply of people to replace our current partner with. And as a result, again, this impossible standards that we hold for love are never met.
Bennett Helm.
I would agree. There is, to a certain extent, a mythology about love, but I think it's partly a shallow mythology about love that doesn't recognize the way in which love involves very deep interpersonal relationships, deep interpersonal relationships that we need to work on and we need to constantly re-engage with our partners in the process of loving them. I think this is a problem not just for romantic love, but I think it's a problem for other types of love as well, familial sorts of love, friendship love. We always need to engage intimately with our beloveds, so as to fulfill the promise of love, but it's not going to be this sort of mythological thing that's falling in love with your ideal. Once you've achieved the love, you know, everything will be happy ever after. That's not the kind of thing that love is.
Bennett Helm, something belongs in here that you've written about. You've called this individualistic approach. What is the difference between this individualistic approach versus this pluralist approach?
Part of the question is how we should understand the nature of intimacy, the kind of intimacy that is characteristic of love. And I think in some philosophical approaches to understanding love, there's a tendency to understand intimacy in terms of sort of your own concern for yourself, so egocentrically. And the way we make sense of my concern for another is in part by understanding the other's interests to be a part of my own interest. That gives rise to various problems about, you know, how you can maintain the distinctness of the identity of the two individuals. If you're breaking down the boundaries between them in such a way that you can't identify some interests as yours versus your beloved's, it gives rise to problems about how we can make sense of how my love involves a concern for the other, for my beloved's sake, with an idea that I think is central to the notion of love. So part of the problem then is to figure out a way to reconceive that notion of intimacy. And, well, part of what I've tried to do in some of my works and part of what I'm trying to do by thinking about the way in which love involves these distinctively interpersonal emotions is to try to reconceive that notion of intimacy in a way that gives rise to a much more robust, much more interpersonal understanding of the nature of love.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the phenomenon of love. Simon May, you've also talked about this idea of individualism, and you've talked about self-love as the other side of the coin of other love. How does that fit in?
Before I answer that question, may I comment on some things Bennett Helm has said? Because I think there's a kind of central point that, if I could say this, is missing in what he's saying, which is he's talking about intimacy and the dynamics of intimacy and actually raising a number of questions that Aristotle raised about how you can see the other person as a second self, but nonetheless the process is directed by your own interest. But I think Bennett Helm is not distinguishing between, as it were, the dynamics of intimacy and what this whole intimacy is actually for. In other words, when we're intimate with somebody, when we say we love them, when we want to combine our lives and combine our projects and so on, or be second selves to each other, what is driving us? What are the values external to that intimacy? I mean, why do we think we're doing all this? And I think that Benatel sounds like he's focusing on the, you know, what's going on in the intimacy and how to make some of those things work. But the larger question is, what do we think we're doing this for? Now, there was a time when people thought they were doing all this for God. So they were loving the other and they were figuring out, you know, the virtues of intimacy and so on, because there was this larger thing which was called loving God, which was the primary duty. Then there were other thinkers who thought that they were doing this because it was part of a flourishing life. So that would be, say, Aristotle, who thought that human flourishing depended on this. And I think this is where my point, which Benatel disagreed with about religion, comes in, which is that I think Nietzsche rightly said that human beings have an inextinguishable religious need. And to be precise, and this is why I mentioned the supreme value, a religion must, among other things, posit some state of affairs which is venerated as supremely valuable. In fact, you can call it sacred, because through it, salvation from whatever we most fear in life can be found. Now, I think love has started to play this role. In other words, that love is this precisely this supreme state of affairs, venerated as supremely valuable, in fact as sacred, and we speak of love as sacred, because in some sense, through love, we can find salvation from, you know, the many things that we fear, loss of career, loss of money, loss indeed of relatives and loved ones. And I think that one has to focus on that, because that's one of the things that's driving love today. Once you've focused on that, you can then focus in on, well, how do we then get this intimacy? How do we achieve this intimacy? What is it to identify with the projects of one's loved one? If we do so, as Bennett just said, do we in some sense dissolve our individuality if we regard the other as a second self? So I think all the questions he's asking are great, but they do need to be situated in a larger context, which is, what purposes do we see the intimacy as serving?
I do agree with much of what Simon has just said, and this is getting partly to the question that you had asked earlier about the sense in which love involves evaluations. In coming to love someone, we're finding that person to be valuable and important, not only for their sakes, but also valuable and important in our own lives. And part of the way in which we can justify a loving relationship is in terms of the way in which that loving relationship affects and changes and deepens your own sense of your own identity. And this is kind of getting to some of those issues that Simon was just raising about what the dynamics of intimacy is for. Why do we go in for this kind of thing?
And allow me to say, Bennett, that you've just given a classically modern answer to the question I raised. So the idea, for example, I think you just mentioned that love in some sense deepens our sense of identity. One can more or less trace to the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and before him, or certainly before the 18th century, nobody would have given an answer like that. So you are answering the question I pose, but you're answering it as a modern, which is fine. But I think it just does illustrate that we do need to raise the question and check with ourselves what larger purposes we do see love as serving.
Now, if we do fast forward to the modern age, which is what Robert Epstein is studying, Robert Epstein, you've studied how love develops, how people actually come to love. And there are these various aspects that we've been talking about in them, but you found specific experiences as very key. What were those?
Yes, I've been studying how love arises in arranged marriages in about a dozen different cultures around the world, looking specifically at marriages in which there was little or no love at first, and indeed that's very common in arranged marriages, in which over time love emerged. And the question is, how does that happen? And I've looked at 36 different factors over a period of time, and it turns out that the number one factor, the best predictor of the growth of love, and this relates to several things that my colleagues here have spoken about, but the number one factor is actually a commitment, how strongly you're committed to making the relationship work. And, of course, commitment tends to be very weak right now in most Western cultures when it comes to long-term relationships. That's one of the reasons why love often fails for us. I just want to bring up another recent study of mine, which I think is relevant to this discussion. I've also looked at seven different types of skill sets, which seem to predict the success of long-term love relationships. And the most important skill set that is the most predictive is communication. That's no big surprise. But the second most predictive skill set, and this is a big surprise, at least it was to me, regarding the success of a loving relationship, is knowledge of partners. And this is, goes to that intimacy question that's been raised several times. That is to say, how much effort do you put into knowing your partner? And that means not just knowing, you know, his or her favorite pizza toppings, but knowing his or her most intimate thoughts, his or her hopes and dreams for the future and so on. Extremely important. So one can study these issues empirically, and it's quite illuminating.
The other aspect of your research I thought was interesting was how vulnerability plus empathy increases people's experience of love.
Yes, this is something I'm studying now, and it's going to take me a few more years, I think, to straighten it all out. But there's a big question about how intimate feelings develop between two people. And it turns out under certain conditions, those can, those feelings will develop almost instantaneously. So, for example, if you and a total stranger are near the site of 9/11 when the buildings came down, which in fact I happen to be, you form an emotional bond, very deep emotional bond that can last a lifetime with whoever happens to be standing next to you, believe it or not. Two men in a foxhole during war form very deep emotional bonds. So the key to this is indeed vulnerability. Now, it's how weak you are and your willingness to show how weak you are, how vulnerable you are to another person. And if two people do that at the same time to each other, if they each just lower their defenses, in effect, that causes bonding, very deep emotional bonding, often expressed in the language of love. So I've been looking at how one can make this happen, literally at the drop of a dime. I now have a number of exercises that very quickly make people feel vulnerable in each other's presence and indeed report very strong increases in emotional bond. And in fact, they will talk about liking, attraction, and love itself just by going through these kinds of experiences.
I would think that would require that empathy piece, but also the element of trust.
Well, of course, because when you are vulnerable, that means you could be hurt by the other person. So issues of trust are very important there. And in fact, some of us are let down. The classic case is the case of the womanizer, the one who manipulates women, who seduces women. In that case, what's happening is that you cause the woman to feel vulnerable in your presence. Sometimes your sheer physicality that makes her feel vulnerable. And when she is now vulnerable, of course, you can take advantage and let her down, so betray her trust. So, yes, as soon as you become vulnerable, issues of trust become very important.
What I wanted to end on deals with another area of love. It's this love of country, which can be translated to nationalism, which sounds a lot like, Simon May, how you have expressed love becoming like a religion. Where does love of country come into all this?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. I should have actually included nationalism and patriotism as one of my isms. And of course, love of country, nationalistic or patriotic, depending on how you want to see it, has indeed been one of the great religions, not necessarily to great benefit, since the beginning of the death of God, as Nietzsche proclaimed it, in the 18th and 19th centuries. So I think that, in a sense, anything to which we feel profoundly attached can become an object of love, and country is one of those. But I think in the West, we've come to be more mature about that. I think there are very few, except at the fringes, who regard love of country in a sense as über alles, as in a sense taking precedence over everything else and over every other love and loyalty. And indeed, I think there are very few who think that that should be entirely unconditional, so that you should unconditionally support everything that your country does. So in fact, I would include love of country. It's definitely to be included in the list of loves, but I think it's one of the substitutes for God, which we have had to very ugly effect in some cases, obviously like German Nazism and so on, which has now taken a bit of a backseat.
And finally, Bennett Helm, let's bring you back in because you've talked about various kinds of love in your book. What are we leaving out?
One thing that I would caution very much against is making the notion of love, the concept of love, too broad. So rather than saying what we're leaving out, I want to try to contract the notion a little bit. I think there are important distinctions to be made between the kind of intimate relationship, the kind of concern that we have for other adult human beings, and the kinds of concern that we might have for a country, for certain kinds of activities, even the kinds of concern that we have for, you know, very young children. Part of what I take the intimacy to involve is, in a certain sense, the sharing of an identity, which presupposes that the beloved herself has a distinctive identity as a particular person. And I think when you look at, for example, infants, they haven't yet developed an identity. Now, I wouldn't want to say that we don't love our infants. Surely you do, in some sense, love newborn infants. But I think the quality and the character of the kind of concern that you have for a newborn is going to be very different, different in kind, from the kind of concern that you have for a mature adult. And I think we can say similar things about love of country, love of certain kinds of activities, love of wine or food or what have you. Many of those things tend to be very different, and I think we need to keep the differences in mind.
My producer over here says, ask them for Valentine's advice.
This is Robert Epstein. I'd be happy to offer some Valentine's Day advice. The main advice I can give you is be careful about who it is you're loving. In other words, try to find out who that person is. Don't just go with feelings. Use your head as well a little bit, because one of the mistakes we make in our culture is we just get so passionate about someone and the physical attraction takes over, and we forget about other kinds of issues. So just be a little bit careful.
I would say don't be too perfectionist about the other. If it doesn't all feel right on the day, it doesn't mean that it's all not going well. Romance doesn't live or die by perfection.
Let me just thank you all for your time and your research.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Simon May is visiting professor of philosophy at King's College in London and author of numerous books, including Love, A History, and Nietzsche's Ethics and His War on Morality. Bennett Helm is professor of philosophy at Franklin and Marshall College. His books include Love, Friendship, and the Self, and Emotional Reason, Deliberation, Motivation, and the Nature of Value. Robert Epstein is senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. He's currently working on a book called Making Love, How People Learn to Love and How You Can Too, and Cognition, Creativity, and Behavior, Selected Essays. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.